Blog Talk Radio.
You know, there's one thing about this show that just never grows old. It's this. Hello. Hello. Masonic Effects. We've thrown the door wide open again and invited you to join us for a little while to talk about our sensibilities, our sense of this pretty interesting craft that we're part of. We can talk about our sense of belonging and what it means to us and the influences and the relevance and ought to, when we think about it, ought to have some of that in mind when we go about our business. Ideals into a lifestyle, something of a real substance. That's an interesting chore, or is it chore or task? I think, or challenge. So I'm here to say we've done it for another week in order to think about what it. You know, at the end of the show, I always encourage us all to commit those acts of random Masonic kindness, because I think the randomness is just so exquisitely Masonic. It's like when I walk into a room where I know that there are men capable of a tremendous level of subtlety, not subterfuge, subtlety. That they've been groomed, they've been practiced, they've been rehearsed, they've been thoughtful, and they've been raised and begun teaching themselves how to engage in a much more pleasant, positive way with the people around them. And the pleasure of being in the company of people that can be pushed not in some simplistic kind of dust up, for a right and wrong, but to press each other for more depth in explanation. And we know that we do that in dialogue. It helps us to clarify our own thinking. And it's based, our ability to do that is largely based on trust. I don't want to talk much more about the antagonism other than to say it's there, but it's a marker. It's not necessarily something we can avoid, but it is a marker or beacon, I think, of people who have decided that the world of ideas is not for them, that they can be a literal a Mason without being, they can be a substantive Mason without being philosophical about it. I presume that the benchmarks don't waver, they don't bend because I choose to be part of, you know, every appendant order that I can get that we find. And that's been happening around us, and it's one of those interesting phenomena. I have a whole generation of fellas that needed to feel that they did it all, that to be complete, you needed to check off the boxes, needed to hold some rank in these vast bureaucracies, and, you know, quick rapid turnover, not a lot, of course, because it's so rapid, the timing, to pull a group together in such a short period of time is remarkably difficult, and so we see that we seem to fit into, have fallen into a narrative that's very, very uncomfortable, I think. The narrative being that we are always not quite up to standard, not quite performing our ritual the way it deserves, not quite mentoring the way the entered apprentice deserves. Somewhat in a rush, as if anything less than a hurry is somehow bad manners, that it's thoughtless, that it's actually wasting time. How these are things, 21st century, my goodness, we have a chance to, as we always have, we have a chance to examine, hold ideas at arm's length, to discuss in terms of archetypes, to examine these snapshots that are only temporarily frozen in time, to help us understand. And to the delight of, I don't know, all of us, we have this river, this torrent of opinion that is such a mainstream. However, it becomes quite easy to navigate. And I want to pick up on a notion that it was told to me, taught to me loosely around Zen master conversation with his student, which I just thought was wonderful in its simplicity. The struggle, you know, the struggle. We can cling, but here's the Zen master gave his student a beautiful mindset, a view of himself as a chip of wood floating on this torrential river. It is up and down the cascades, but it always floats along on the top. And you go with the torrent, this life force, not maybe butterfly wings affecting the hurricane, but you know the resistance is over. It's now curiosity. Where are we going? Which direction will we go in? Are we dropping? Will the drop stop? Will we resurface? And you think about the imagery that we can use, that we do use, that alleviates this sense of not being up to snuff, not being able to understand the standards. So I, rather than fool around and have all of us, you know, marching in a close formation and trying to convince ourselves that this is the path to insight, we have that, you know, there's no question we have that. But I'm looking for to introduce one and all to this casual intensity where it's expected. It's not all hailed. It's expected. It's what bright minds do when they get together. It's a very, very interesting, I think, phenomena, especially as you grow older. It's lovely when you mature into the role. Now, I know what you're going to say. You're going to say, tell me that there are people there are men out there that are just irritated. They're irritated with themselves and they're irritated with the people around. Yes, that's, we were never told that we would have the gift of clairvoyance. This isn't a laying on of hands. I don't know if I wish that sometimes that we didn't have the slogan "Make good men better." It's an interesting sentiment, but I think it can set certain minds and up for to feel that this is a passive process. I just go through this, I'm redefined, I go through my initiation, I'm redefined, I'm given particular tasks, but whether I choose to follow them or not, that's entirely up to me. And around me, a lot of the brethren aren't taught, and so they don't know. They're not taught the beauty of the landmarks, they're not taught the beauty of the symbols. They are there for self-exploration, except I think that's a bit of a cop-out. It's like you're going to take me through the most beautiful art gallery, the most incredible art gallery in the world, and I'm not going to look at any of the art. How's that? I just find that odd. First, why would I, if it was me, why would I take somebody through an art gallery that's not interested? Well, it might, if we sat down and had a cup of tea before and said, what about if we walk through together and see what we can find, what messaging we can pull from the artwork? What was the artist trying to say to us? What emotion were they trying to elicit? And were they successful? Was it the sculptor's mastery? Was it the tonation, or was it the story that the artist was portraying? We have that and so much more. The human condition does not hesitate. Give us that mulligan, you know, go and start all over again. Life goes on, and it's not without its trials. And of course, we will feel doubtful at certain points. That's natural, isn't it? It is. It's natural. And then we'll feel that. In the order of things, we would expect nothing less. Today, I struggled, brethren, to bring out ideas that are respectful of your wide expertise and your the uniqueness of your worldview. These are Masonic Effects is about conversation. I hope that you know that I always wait for the conversation, the articles that we read, the commentaries. And then I hope in a way that you, the brethren in New Zealand or, you know, that part of the world or Brazil, the Southern Hemisphere will be enthralled in their own way with this source from the Northern Hemisphere, pointing out some things that I believe we share in common. I don't think it's easy for anybody to assume a virtuous life. I could be wrong, but I don't think it's easy. I think it takes a while to understand what that feels like, and I don't know if that ever stops. What does it feel like when you're betrayed? What does it feel like when you've been misled or when you've been played the fool? Oh, sometimes I smile when somebody's trying to do some silly kind of manipulation. They're either, these days are. It puzzles me that grown men will think that if they want something and they want a little bit of control, that exhibiting an unpleasant part of their character is somehow influential. I believe the thinking is this will teach them that if they don't agree with me, I'll become so unpleasant until they comply. Ah, yeah. You've met the type. They're parked in the corner. They're never going to amount to a whole lot. They just do what they do, and they would just, plant some pretty flowers or something around them so they can at least have a nice view. Put a mirror in front of them, they'll be happy. No. This is like it's not quite the rapture, but there's a lot of very interesting things going on in Masonry around. And I think the small group is pretty pumped. We can find some very, very amazing works going on right today. And as if we needed a little poke in the ribs to remind us, we can attempt to, and I believe, to establish harmonics in our lodge through talking and consensus. I think that's wonderful. What to do if and when that doesn't happen? What to do is what men have done for a long, long time. You either decide to sit and wallow in your own self-pity, or you dust yourself off, you put your kit together, and you move along this journey of life by yourself. Oh my goodness, that's the partnership that's always been our way of life. We're born alone and we die alone. Not to be dramatic about it, but in the meantime, we have these, I think, stimulating conversations. And it doesn't change the world. The conversation may not, but what we do with those ideas certainly does. Yep, it is sometimes, and we know that we can pass on a smile, but we can have effect on people around us. We know more about the psychology of communication connections. We know that. Because as hard as it is, we do embrace science. We are the science and the arts. And that is, it was so much easier just winging it, wasn't it? Tossing out any loose idea without a lot of substance to it, without a lot of lot of fact, you know. Why? The fact just gums up the works. We don't have to bother ourselves with all those facts. We can just wing it. But, ooh, you know that line, is all-seeing eye beholds us? Well, we're the all-seeing eye. We know. When we're winging it, we're just injecting personality and ego into this beautiful garden of philosophical inclination. It's just amazing. So back today, you're not going to be part of the seven liberal arts and sciences. You're not a part of that, I don't think. You're a student of that range of study. That's very, very old, very, very ancient, and is still with us. Here, the age of an idea doesn't dismiss it. We bring it forward. You do it in science. You do it in the arts. Why would you think we wouldn't do it in a tile lodge? Oh, have some remarkable music to accompany these ideas. And the poem, I've been saving this for a while. It's considered the oldest Masonic document, circa 1390. It's in the Masonic Museum. Can any of you guess? Can any of you guess? You already know. One manuscript that varies so much from others in its form and in its content as to afford the strongest inside evidence that it has come down to us from a source entirely different from that which gave origin to other and later documents. We referred to what is known to Masonic antiquarians as the Halliwell or Regius manuscript. Yep. Well, it's here. Been waiting too long. Let's see if it whets our appetite a little bit listening to Herbie Hancock. He's been around for a very, very long time. This is a tune that was remastered. It's called The Lone and I. It's from his work in 2007. Not that long ago. Dexter Gordon, Freddie Hubbard, you know, Butch Warren, Billy Higgins. Not a bad crowd. So we just sit back and linger over that. Being touched by masonry. I'm going to try and convince you today to show the ancient charges some love. Take them out. Reread them. No rush. No rush. There's nothing compelling except your curiosity. Here. I ran out of words and tried to boil this down. See what you think of this. It's being touched by masonry. Education gives us the tools needed to articulate thought. Should stop and think about that. Thought, ideas as words. That's the way the brain works. What are the thoughts before their words? It is not exclusive, but education brings vocabulary with meanings into our bearing. The exchange of ideas is enriched by our use of words. As soon as we think we grasp one meaning, we find context changes understanding. Changes meaning. So does intent. Words do have more than one meaning. Masonry, where the individual is transformed into a lodge, where ethics prevail. Well, our collective is where optics are impactful, where being and seeing each other turned out in kind reinforces our place in a grand, ordered way of thinking and being. It is where we entertain the skeptic and the stoic, where enthusiasm is examined for clouding thinking. The product of self-awareness is graphic. Looking at influences mixes guilt with truth. All those influences, my goodness. Outside the popular ways, looking in is not to everybody's, outside of the popular ways, it's not to everybody's taste. Challenge after challenge, we learn once an idea is assimilated, we need to find evidence it exists and it's valid. Moments. Something stops when that happens. All doubt that one person is insignificant fades away. We learn to value the potential of a social contract. Thanks, Rousseau. Thanks, Rousseau. So we wrestle. Deterministic? Literal? Metaphysical? Is it as above, so below? Is that part of the framework that you're operating on? The inner man? I do love me some John Coltrane and McCoy Tyner. My poetry here. Before I get into, you know, the Regius poem, the Halliwell manuscript, I need to just a little heads up here about poetry. Why poetry? What it does for us. You're probably, I'm guessing here, you're not going to likely tune in to another mention of poetry as you go through the week. You may, but you may not. So just a little refresher here about the importance. Like we're looking at something from 1390 that was written as a poem. Mnemonic, you know, and it makes you think, is ritual, could we look at ritual as a poem, as poetry? Well, I think there's an argument for that. Poetry, and here I'm looking at a newsletter. This is from a site called The Conversation. Academic rigor and journalistic flair. Under the title, this is from October 2nd, 2018, poetry has the power to inspire change like no other art form. So is anyone making you? Of course not. You know, your growth is your doing, but we can facilitate. Culturally, poetry is used in a variety of ways. Haikus, for example, juxtapose images of the everyday, while lyric poetry expresses the personal and emotional. And similarly, poets themselves come in a range of guises. Think of the romantic poet engaged with the sublime, the penniless artist in their garret, the highbrow don, the bard, the soldier on the front line, the spoken word performer, the national poet, the poet laureate, or the macaire. Sometimes educators encounter a fear of poetry in students who have previously been put off by former teachers. And I think that's the case for a lot of us, which is regrettable. Little kids that ought to have been exposed to the high arts were ignored. Such teachers are perhaps intimidated by verse themselves, presenting it as a kind of algebra with an answer to be uncovered through some obscure metric code. But this fear disperses when students are given the confidence to interpret and engage with poetry on their own terms. Yeah, that's the beauty. It's like the beauty of masonry. It's on your terms. You interpret. you give me a help me with a, and I'll listen to your reasoned answer. We often talk about students needing to find their own voice. Poetry does that. It is claimed to be as relevant now as ever. I would think that's like, time. Or is it time, the measurement of time, no longer relevant? Whether you are a regular reader of poetry, the chances are at some point in your life you will reach out to poetry. People look to poems most often at times of change. Auld Lang Syne, eh? And I think of all the music that are around today that is poetry set to poetry as lyrics. People look to poems during change, and these can be happy or sad, like birthdays or funerals. Poetry can provide clear expression of emotion at moments that are overwhelming and burdensome. It's claimed, and I love this idea, poetry is also used to mark periods of change that are often celebrated through public events. Remembrance Sunday, for example, in the wake of the shocking Manchester Arena bombing, a fellow named Tony Walsh, This Is the Place, gave the city a voice. Remember that? That wasn't so long ago. The communication of personal experiences like these in poetry uses direct and intermediate terms. Nothing of him that doth fade, but doth suffer a sea change into something rich and strange. That's from Shakespeare's The Tempest. We are told death is a transformation rather than an end. So with that in mind, if you look for that as we go through this, please. And I'm going to start off with a little fun fact. Why do Freemasons end their prayers with the phrase, "So mote it be"? I'll just read that and think we're heading toward the Regius manuscript. It's customary in contemporary English to end prayers with a hearty amen, a word meaning so be it. It is a Latin word derived from the Hebrew word, meaning certainly. Thus a congregation saying amen is literally saying so be it. The word mote is an archaic verb that means may or might and traces back to Old English. The phrase so mote it be means so may it be, which is the same as so be it. Why do Masons end their prayers with so mote it be? The answer goes back to the Regius poem of about 1390, the oldest known Masonic document, and it's one of the old charges or Gothic constitution used by early Freemasons to regulate their trade. It has a legendary history. Regulations to guide the Mason trade and rules of manners and moral conduct. And the poem ends famously with this couplet. Amen, amen, so mote it be, so say we all for charity. That's Freemasons today end their prayers the same way they did in 1390. The next time you're in lodge and say, so mote it be, after the chaplain finishes a prayer, remember that you are continuing a 600-year-old Masonic tradition. What do we say about this? This is an amazing, amazing poem. And I am such a fan of old charges. I just think that this is like the mine, the diamond mine that was sealed off a long, long time ago, and it's been reopened. And oh my goodness, it's just full of richness, just full of it. This is one of a number. There are a number of Masonic manuscripts that are important in the if you're looking at the emergence of Masonry, it's worthwhile to be able to pick up the thread, which thread depends on you. These documents outline a history of Masonry and tracing its origins to a biblical or classical root And it was followed by the regulations of the organization and the responsibilities of different grades. But more rare are old handwritten copies of ritual afforded a limited understanding of early Masonic rites. All of those which predate the formation of Grand Lodges are found in Scotland and Ireland and show such similarity that the Irish rituals are usually assumed to be of Scottish origin. The earliest minutes of lodges formed before the first Grand Lodge are also located in Scotland. Early records of the first Grand Lodge in 1717 allow an elementary understanding of the immediate pre-Grand Lodge era and some insight into the personalities and events that shaped early 18th century Freemasonry in Britain. Other early documentation is included. The Kirkwell scroll is a hand-painted roll of linen, probably used as a floor cloth, and it's now in the care of a lodge in Orkney. Its dating and the meaning of its symbols have generated a lot of debate. Early operative documents and the later printed constitutions are just briefly covered here. The old charges of the Masons' lodges were documents describing the duties of the members, to part of which the charges every Mason had to swear on admission. For this reason, every lodge has had a copy of its charges, occasionally written into the beginning of the minute book, but usually as a separate manuscript roll of parchment. With the coming of Grand Lodges, these were largely superseded by printed constitutions, but the Grand Lodge of All England at York and the few lodges that remained independent in Scotland and Ireland retained the handwritten charges as their authority to meet as a lodge. The founders of Quatuor Coronate Lodge, Woodford, Hewan, Spaeth, and Gould, and Dr. Begemann, a German Freemason, produced much published work in the second half of the 19th century. They collated, cataloging, and classifying the available material. And since then, aside from the occasional rediscovery of an old document, little has been done to update the field. The oldest, get to the point, the Regius poem, is unique in being set in verse. The rest, of which there are over 100 survive, usually have a three-part construction. They start with a prayer, invocation of God, or a general declaration, followed by a description of the seven liberal arts: logic, grammar, rhetoric, arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy, extolling geometry above the others. There follows a history of the craft and how it came to the British Isles, usually culminating in a general assembly of Masons during the reign of King Æthelstan. The last part consists of the charges or regulations of the lodge and the craft of Masonry in general, which the members are bound to maintain. So remember, the earliest Masonic documents are those of their early employers, the church and the state. The first claim by modern Freemasons as the lineal ancestors of their own charges relate to the self-organization of Masons as a fraternity with mutual responsibilities. From the reign of Henry VI to the Elizabethan period, that is from 1425 to 1550, surviving documents show the evolution of a legend of Masonry, starting about the flood, before the flood, and culminating in the reestablishment of the craft of Masonry in York during the reign of King Æthelstan. So the Halliwell manuscript, also known as the Regius poem, is the earliest of the old charges, and it consists of 64 vellum pages in Middle English written in rhyming couplets. And in this, it differs from the prose of all the later charges. The poem begins by describing how Euclid counterfeited geometry and called it masonry for the employment of the children of the nobility in ancient Egypt. It then recounts the spread of the art of geometry in, quote, diverse lands. The document relates how the craft of masonry was brought to England during the reign of King Æthelstan, 924 to 939. It tells how all the masons of the land came to the king for direction as to their own good governance, and how Æthelstan, together with the nobility and landed gentry, forged the 15 articles and 15 points for their rule. This is followed by 15 articles for the master concerning both moral behavior: do not harbor thieves, do not take bribes, attend church regularly, etc., and the operation of work on a building site: do not make your masons labor at night, teach apprentices properly, do not take jobs that you cannot do. There are then 15 points for craftsmen which follow a similar pattern. Warnings of punishment for those breaking the ordinances are followed by provision for annual assemblies. There follows the legend of the four crowned martyrs, a series of moral aphorisms, and finally a blessing. The origins of the Regius are obscure, but we know it was donated to the British Museum in 1757 by King George II to form the nucleus of the present British Library. It came to the attention of Freemasonry much later, and this oversight being mainly due to the librarian David Casley, who described it as a poem of moral duties when he cataloged it in 1734. It was in the 1838-39 session of the Royal Society that James Halliwell, who was not a Mason, delivered a paper on the, quote, early history of Freemasonry in England based on the Regius, which was published in 1840, his paper was. The manuscript was updated in 1390 and supported by the authorities of the day. Now, let's just tuck into a little piece of this, shall we? Yeah, this is quite an amazing piece of work. And I won't, oh my goodness, I've given far too much indication already here. Dean, just to give you, this is the old charges refer to ancient documents that have come down to us from the 14th century and afterwards, in which are incorporated the traditional history, the legends, the rules and regulations of Masonry. So when you read this, you begin to realize that the subsequent Grand Lodges have been translating and operationalizing these guidelines. This is the source. So equip yourself. And all we do, your interpretation will be right in every way, of course. But so will mine, and so will all these other good brethren. But you see the genius at work. This is not for faint-hearted people to put together a constitution and then start to implement bylaws. And just to translate this, knowing this doesn't go away. But I tend to think myself that this gives us source material that is exquisite. For all our constitutions and statutes and laws and rules and bylaws, to some extent, can be traced back to the old charges. Here, the author finishes the with a list of 15 points. I'll just read some. I'll try and see if we can get through them all. A master mason must be worthy of the confidence of the lords. He must pay the fellows a fair wage with the lord's money. Every master mason must attend a general assembly unless he can give a good excuse. A master mason shall not take on an apprentice for less than 7 years and must lodge him during his apprenticeship. A master mason must not take any serfs as apprentice. A master mason shall take on neither bastards nor cripples. An apprentice shall be paid less than the fellows, but his salary shall increase as he progresses. A master mason shall employ neither thieves nor murderers. A master mason may discharge an incompetent worker and replace him with another. A master mason must make sure that the foundation of the building is well laid. A master mason must never take over or meddle with the work of another master mason or be fined a penalty of £10. Woo. A mason shall not work at night except to study. One shall not disparage the work of one's fellows. There's a bit of professionalism there. A master mason must give his apprentice a complete education. A master mason shall not take on an apprentice unless he has enough work for him. And the 15th, the master mason must not leave his fellows astray because he must care about their souls. The Rajaya's manuscript is the only version of the old charges to be written in meter. It may have been composed by a priest, and there are some 800 lines in the poem, the strictly Masonic portion coming to an end at line 576, which begins a sermonette on moral duties. Here, those points are: a man of the craft must love God, the church, and his fellows. Masons must be paid for holidays, and on. I'll leave that with you. Does that resonate? Does it resonate? Poetry? We use it to explore the potential for change. And here I think we're looking at self-awareness and the expression. Yeah, I think so. And not only that, I think we're looking to enjoy it. Enjoy it. Yes, if that's what we think when we roll up our sleeves and set to work. Joy? Lester Young, 1952, Stardust. Lester Young. That'll keep us focused. Here, we've been speaking about, this is a history portion, of course. We've been talking about transitions. And here we begin wrapping up this book on living the Enlightenment, you know, the values that came in and the changes. And this, we're approaching this as a surge, as almost like a wave. I think of it coming out of Britain and Bavaria and Stockholm and Amsterdam and Paris and Edinburgh and Dublin. And of course, London. We are seeing how it's being digested in a fairly diverse and cultures. You know, what effect and there was a knock-on effect that we've been reading about for quite some time, and here we're looking at, you know, we're just moving from Frederick II. To Louis XV of France. This was a phenomenon for the establishment, for the aristocracy. And it was even decades later we learned that Louis XVI was venerated by men and women of La Nation Mecon for his reforming instincts. He wasn't that popular politically, but he was known for reforming instincts. And the French women's lodges of adoption, with their strongly aristocratic base, were especially appreciative of Louis XVI and careful to compare him to other monarchical reformers. Dutch lodges were told by their masters that the principal duty of masonry consists in obedience to its sovereigns and in the exact observation of the laws. In 1765, when a brother joined riots against the civil and academic authority in the university town of Leiden, he was expelled to show how much Freemasons love good order and the duty of subjects to the government. Even in the early 1790s, when the Stadtholderate were being maintained by Prussian soldiers, Masonic almanacs reprinted orations from an earlier era praising the hereditary Stadtholderate. The King of Sweden, who we met earlier as he entertained the Stockholm lodges, received similar praise in the French language almanacs. In the Austrian Netherlands, the Habsburg administration had early on allied itself with the Enlightenment. It was the stick with which to beat the clergy and to attack the privileges of the indigenous aristocracy. By the 1780s, Belgian Freemasonry was firmly in the camp of the monarch in Vienna, or at least so it seemed on the surface. Austrian lodges were particularly active in promoting the new science, a favored cause of enlightened monarchs locked in struggles with their local clergies. In the Austrian colony of Belgium, Joseph II was loudly praised by the lodges as a reformer, a king whose glory exceeded even that of Louis XIV. Then in late 1786, Joseph II tried to bring Belgian Freemasonry under his control. He closed down all but three lodges, one in the capital city of each of the Belgian provinces. He did so in the name of order. These assemblies, it goes on, abandoned entirely to themselves, have taken off in every direction, and by a fanatical liaison, have not been conducive direction. And by a fanatical liaison, have not been conducive to the perfect equity. The most brothers docilely conformed, but a few did not. The very next year, the same almanac that printed the decree, along with a damning comparison to the protection the order had enjoyed in Prussia, printed an oration that needs to be heard. Quote, "We wanted to imitate them, the kings, the sovereigns, the magistrates who were established, but alas, the power is without boundary, the authority without limits, the slavery absolute. And the Mason generally only finds the happy alliance of sovereignty and liberty in his lodges." In the same small book was printed another oration which exhorted, "The Masons must be a moral man, faithful to the government under which he has the happiness to live." The choices seem fairly obvious. The enlightened Freemason could either retreat into his lodge and contemplate the nature of the arbitrary power surrounding him, or he could conform. It seems reasonable to argue that the emperor's move contributed to the discontent that made for revolution in the Austrian Netherlands in the 1787. You think? And we'll pick this up going on, the use of the lodges as places where praise of monarchs mixed with the Enlightenment. I think that would work very nicely. Thank you. I hope you found the program entertaining and a bit informative. I hope so, and relaxing. Thank you for sitting and pulling up a chair and a glass of your favorite and joining us today. We look forward to having you with us again in a few short days. In the meantime, commit those acts of random Masonic kindness and include yourself in that mix, please. See you soon. Thanks so much.